This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Oil is a coming from deep down below. Fishies and shrimpies have nowhere to go. Can't seem to stop it. It's out of control. Corporate catastrophe is running the show.
Black oil, millions of years old, gushes out of a gash in the Gulf of Mexico. One of the world's largest companies, BP, formerly British Petroleum, says it's 1,000 barrels a day, then 5,000. Satellite photos suggest 25,000 a day. In a closed session to Congress, BP admits they don't know. It could be 40 to 60,000 barrels a day. The governor of Louisiana prepares for 100,000 barrels. The spill is really a man-made volcano underwater. I'm Alex Smith. This accident taps a primeval fear in the human mind. Something dark and uncontrollable rushes up out of the belly of the earth, poisoning the global oceans. Could that really happen? Madness ensues. Right-wing radio's Rush Limbaugh suggests the giant rig Deepwater Horizon was bombed by environmentalists. Others say a North Korean submarine did it. During two administrations, BP lulled regulators to sleep with assurances and campaign contributions. All that dirt will leak out, too. Meanwhile, 20,000 feet below the Gulf waters, the giant Macondo field spurts out a relentless wave of fossil carbon suspected to equal a new Exxon Valdez spill every 3 days. So many victims, so many tales to tell. In this Radio EcoShock report, you'll hear from the activist who knew this was coming. Ricky Ott, marine biologist, fisherwoman, and the conscience of Valdez, Alaska, checks in from New Orleans. Antonio Yuhas, oil researcher from Global Exchange, introduces us to BP and its lobby in Washington. Peak oil guru Richard Heinberg looks at the big picture impact. And former Shell executive Anita Burke finds the inside track and the real culprits. We'll end with a new song, Corporate Catastrophe, written about the spill by Dana Pearson and heard first on your Radio EcoShock. From New Orleans, we are joined by Dr. Ricky Ott, marine biologist and former commercial fisher person in Alaska. She was among the first to see the Exxon Valdez tanker slick, became a leading activist, and wrote two books, Not One Drop, Betrayal and Courage in the Wake of the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill, and Sound Truth and Corporate Myths, The Legacy of the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill. Ricky, thank you so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
You're very welcome. Thank you for the invite.
I realize you have just arrived in New Orleans, but what are your first impressions?
Well, the first impression is that I need to get to the coast as fast as possible. So we are heading out to where the real impacts are today. There's just a feel in New Orleans like, you know, could be business as usual. We don't know. I mean, it's not the all-engulfing, all-consuming terror and agony that is experienced in these coastal communities that are going to be directly impacted by the oil.
You spent 20 years studying the impact of the Exxon Valdez spill, and am I correct in saying the oil damage is still continuing there?
We have herring fishermen who are not able to fish their permits. Their $300,000 permits have completely devalued to zero. They owe annual payments, and there's accumulating debt on those permits. The herring fisheries are closed indefinitely, and so fishermen today are incurring losses from something that happened 21 years ago. Other fisheries have recovered, like pink salmon, but that one is really dragging down the economy and our fishermen still to this day.
Well, I've read your books, and it seems to me that you are saying that once oil reaches land, it can't really be cleaned up.
I'm still sticking to that. Now, the sweet Louisiana crude that has spilled here has a higher portion of light ends, or a fraction of oil that dissolves more readily into the water column, evaporates more readily, and will be easier to break down with bacteria. Now, having said that, I'm still talking in the order of decades. This is not a fast process. In Alaska, scientists are saying of the oil that's still on our beaches, probably another 20 years, they don't know. So we're looking at 40 to 50 years in Alaska. That process might be hastened a little bit here, but really we can put hair mats and, boom material, but there's still going to be a lot of dissolved oil, and the dissolved oil in the water column will be killing fish eggs, shellfish eggs, like the shrimp eggs, clams, oyster eggs, and larvae. And the killing will not just stop this year. There will be generations of harm because of this spill.
As we speak, the slick has not yet reached the shore. BP is taking some credit, claiming their use of dispersants is working. What are these chemicals, and what is their environmental impact?
These are chemical products that are designed by the oil companies to literally break apart the oil, sheen on the surface, or in the water column, break up the oil into smaller droplets that then are diluted by the ocean volume of seawater. So the solution to pollution is dilution. That's literally what dispersants do. However, dispersant use also involves a trade-off, because any painter knows, or like people who took high school chemistry, like dissolve like. So like we're talking oil. So to dissolve oil, you have to use an oil-based product. And these dispersants are therefore by nature hazardous and toxic. The very first generation of dispersants that came out after the Torrey Canyon spill in 1967 were actually more toxic than the oil. And they were shelved. I actually did research on some of these dispersants, and there were several, now we're several generations later in chemical products. But by nature, these chemicals are hazardous. They contain solvents. In and of themselves, they kill marine life with dissolved oil. What we're looking at is a toxic hit in the water column of everything that's there. It's a trade-off of trying to minimize the amount of oil that makes landfall. Dispersants are not 100% effective. Probably what's going on, and I haven't seen any current maps, but it's current. I know that one of the towns released a bunch of water from the reservoir to try to push the oil offshore. I wouldn't necessarily, it's all dispersants at this time. Dispersants are not 100% effective, like I said, and we're going to probably see a hit in the water column plus, a hit on land when that happens.
I realize this is all kind of a guessing game at this point because it's such a unique situation, but are you personally optimistic that BP's collector dome will work? Their idea of dropping this giant device on top of the well and soaking some oil out of it.
What amazes me about the oil industry is that everything is an experiment. You would think that we as a society, if we're going to sign off contingency plans, we fell for this in Alaska. We believed that the oil industry could clean up after themselves if there was an accident. They had these state and federal approved contingency plans, on paper. It looks like it works, but it turns out when these big spills really happen, there's a lot of guesswork going on, and I have no idea. I know the industry is trying. It's a big mess. Everything is going to take time. I guess we just have to wait and see.
Right. Well, this is playing out in Canada now because the same companies want to drill up in the Beaufort Sea, and they don't want to have any of the safety mechanisms. They were trying to get the government to drop that. Do you see some impact on Arctic offshore drilling coming out of this accident?
Well, what I hope is Exxon Valdez shut down the industry surge to open the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. That's what was going on in 1988, and it probably would have been opened by our Congress in 1989 had it not been for Exxon Valdez. And what I'm hopeful now is that this oil spill here, this leak, really, in the Gulf, will cause some sense and some sanity in our energy legislation. By that, I mean, if you look at the whole energy package, and the cost of global climate change and the global climate crisis, really what we need to do is transition off fossil fuels. So I am hoping that we see a slowing down of outer continental shelf oil and gas leasing, and at a minimum, review of all the oil spill prevention and response laws, of all the other laws where industry has carved out for itself exemptions or weakening, been able to weaken regulations. And I'd like to see all of that on the table, what we've done, and it all tightened back up before we go anywhere.
Ricky, your second book, Not One Drop, focused on the harsh damage happening to the local communities, not just the economic loss, but fights and depressions and so on. What can Gulf communities do to help themselves?
Well, this is actually one of the main reasons I'm down here, is to help the communities, because we wasted a lot of time in Cordova hoping that Exxon would take care of us, hoping that the state or the federal government would take care of us. And it wasn't really until the fish runs collapsed in 1993 as a delayed, when the babies of the year did not materialize 3 and 4 years later, there was a delayed ecosystem collapse. When that ecosystem collapse happened, we realized we had to take care of ourselves. And I'm hoping to help the local community down here realize that even though President Obama has said, we will hold BP accountable, President Obama has no idea that the laws will work against him to make that promise real. It will be impossible. The laws will only hold the oil industry accountable for a very small percent of the harm. So what I'm hoping to do is go down and let people know this. Let people know that our fisheries are still closed 21 years later. Let people know you better have a plan B. Hold peer listening circles where the people sit in circle. And yes, they share their grief, they share their fears, but then they say, what can we do? And these peer listening circles were actually devised by Dr. Steve Picou out of Mobile, Alabama, in studying Cordova as a case study. And these peer listening circles actually help to reduce some of the stress and trauma and switch people from the victim mode into the survivor mode. And that's what I'm hoping to do down here with community education.
As we wrap up, do you have other news or views you would like to pass along?
Well, if people have ideas or suggestions, please contact me through the website rikiott.com. My handler, Lisa Marie, another spill victim, is down here with me, and I'm going to be here for 3 weeks, and I hope to be as useful as possible to the communities that will be impacted.
Our guest has been Dr. Ricky Ott, marine biologist, author, and super expert on oil spills. Ricky, I know you're flooded with media requests. I've seen you on CNN several times. Thank you for taking the time for Radio EcoShock.
And also, Radio EcoShock Canada people, I will be in Kitimat on May 29th for the solidarity celebration of people standing against the Enbridge pipeline. Hope to see you there.
Absolutely. We've got a pipeline to stop here for the same kind of reasons. Thank you again, Ricky.
You bet.
This is Radio EcoShock with Joel Plaskett rocking in the background.
Oil is a-coming from deep down below. Try, can't seem to stop it. It's out of control. Corporate catastrophe is running the show.
Our next guest, Antonio Yuhas, has been following the oil industry for San Francisco-based human rights group Global Exchange. In Britain's Observer newspaper of May 2nd, Antonio writes, "Another fatal accident from BP is a surprise to no one." Antonia, to set the stage, just how big is BP, the company formerly known as British Petroleum?
BP is one of the largest corporations in the world. Its revenues make it larger than most of the countries on the planet. If it was based in the United States, it would be the third largest corporation in the United States after Walmart and Exxon. It's a behemoth and has been for many, many years.
So their gross revenues would be in the hundreds of billions of dollars?
Yeah, its revenues last year in U.S. dollars were $327 billion, give or take.
That's pretty big. Well, according to the Financial Times, high oil prices gave the company's oil and gas unit a 94% rise in profits to $8.3 billion. That kind of money can buy a lot of influence in Washington. What do we know about BP's lobby efforts?
Yeah, I think it surprises most people outside of the United States to understand how large of a lobby presence even non-U.S. companies have here. So BP is one of the top 20 lobbying bodies before the U.S. government. Last year alone, they spent $16 million lobbying the federal government. That doesn't include state-level lobbying. And that's $6 million more than the year before, which itself was also a record-breaking year. So they've definitely been trying to better their image and better the perception among regulators in the United States by spending liberally on lobbying dollars. Until this year in the United States, we had a limit on how much companies could spend on campaigns. BP was still among the top oil companies contributing to campaigns in the United States elections. We're all now pretty afraid of what the impact is going to be on the impact of the Supreme Court's ruling on Citizens United, which essentially now opens the door completely to the same type of money we see spent on lobbying to now be spent on campaigns. So I would anticipate that BP, particularly in light of the explosion, is going to now start matching those lobbying, the campaign spending dollars with the same amount they spend on lobbying.
So if you give them a break on regulation, you might get some campaign money, and if you don't, they may fund your opposition.
Yes.
Oh, that's ugly. Well, can you tell us a little bit about the investigation of BP's Texas City refinery accident, that fatal blowout in 2005?
Yes, that was the last major U.S. workplace incident in the United States. It had been the worst in 15 years when it happened in 2005. 15 workers were killed, about 180 were injured, and the results of the U.S. Chemical Safety Board, which is an independent federal agency that investigated the incident, found BP completely to blame, and the cause of the blame was massive cost-cutting, that BP, while it was experiencing its highest profits in history, was cutting 25% cuts in 1999 and 2005 across the board at all of its U.S. refineries. The investigation found that they were complacent in security, that they were lacking in training, that they were essentially lacking across the board in their attention paid to security and safety and the well-being of their operations. It was a truly damning report, actually, that came out. BP was found guilty of criminal charges, paid a hefty fine. There was definitely changes in the leadership in BP as a result. However, you know, as you said in your introduction, while it's sad to say it, unfortunately it wasn't surprising that when the next great major oil industry explosion happened in the United States, it was once again BP.
This whole breakdown reminds me so much of deregulation on Wall Street. It seems like the industry sets the standards, such as they are, until greed blows the whole thing up. Do you see similarities?
Well, the 8 years of the Bush administration were really an unprecedented party for the oil industry. We had the oiliest government in U.S. history with the president, the vice president, the secretary of state, many other key officials coming directly out of the oil industry. Both President Bush and Condoleezza Rice had actually more experience running oil companies when they took office than they did working for the federal government. And the industry basically was able to stop lobbying and start legislating. They were completely within and of the administration. So we saw an opening up of opportunities for places to drill in the United States, a lack of regulatory oversight and enforcement. We saw subsidies and tax breaks to the industry that really helped fill the bottom lines of this industry and these companies, and a free-for-all. And I think we are paying the consequence of that free-for-all now with this explosion, frankly. And, you know, the Obama administration has been better and has certainly responded to this crisis in a way that we had hoped they would have responded earlier, which was to reverse itself on opening up new offshore areas of the U.S. coast to drilling. The administration has definitely jumped right in and is on the ground in the sites of where the spill is both taking place and where it's washed ashore, which is across four states now. And hopefully we're going to see a regulatory response by the Obama administration, not just harsh words, and to really start rolling back significantly the liberal tendencies of the Bush administration.
This whole deep water drilling, it brings up the whole issue of climate change again, because we've got these massive oil fields. We think that were safely buried, the carbon was safely buried miles below the surface of the earth. Now we're going to bring it out, and whether we leak it into the Gulf or whether we successfully burn it in our SUVs, either way, aren't we just inviting more climate change by doing deep water drilling?
Well, drilling at depths of greater than 500 feet releases methane, a greenhouse gas, you know, estimated about 25 times more intensive, carbon intensive than CO2, far more destructive to the environment. And these rigs in the Gulf that used to be drilling at, you know, 30 to 120 feet are now drilling at 1,000 feet, 5,000 feet. The rig that exploded was drilling at 18,000 feet. BP has a 25,000-foot well out in the U.S. Gulf. You know, we have only begun to appreciate the environmental consequences of this type of offshore drilling. Forget accidents, just the consequences that happened when the drilling is taking place as it should. We know about the release of methane. We know about the release of toxins. We know about the release of all sorts of sediment and toxic-filled sediment through the drilling process, the impact on marine wildlife from the various sonar technology that's used to find the oil fields deep offshore. Then there is the massive network of pipes involved to bring the oil back to shore. These are miles and miles and miles of pipes that stream into the Gulf. And actually, just 2 weeks ago, an Exxon oil tanker snagged a massive pipeline owned by Chevron and leaked 18,000 gallons of oil into the Gulf, and that was just preceding this explosion. The oil drilling also causes coastal erosion. That erosion opens up the door to make it much worse when storms come through. So when Katrina hit, the impact was significantly worse because there wasn't a natural buffer. Moreover, the coastal erosion exposes the oil pipelines. So you now have what used to be underground pipelines are now above ground and are being much more, again, themselves prone to accidents. So even when everything's working as it should, you have a highly polluting, highly dangerous, toxic methane leaking industry. And then, of course, when accident occurs, I mean, I think the average person doesn't quite appreciate, or if you don't have your head stuck in this, how massive these operations are. The drilling that BP is doing, for example, its deepest well at 25,000 feet is deeper down than Mount Everest is up. And there is equipment that is being put out into the ocean that these facilities are as big as the Eiffel Tower. They are enormous, and they are technologically unprecedented in what's needed to keep them going. And then when an accident happens, it's a massive accident. So it's now being estimated that this oil spill is ultimately likely to be worse than the Exxon Valdez spill, making it the worst oil spill in history.
Tell us briefly about your work and your book, The Tyranny of Oil.
Yeah, I released The Tyranny of Oil, The World's Most Powerful Industry and What We Must Do to Stop It in 2008, based on my analysis of the industry and, most importantly, its relationship to the Bush administration and watching this industry build itself to become just hands down the wealthiest industry the world has ever known, having access to more capital than any other industry. For a time there in the early 2000s, the banking sector could challenge the oil sector in terms of its wealth, but then the banking sector crashed, and then the oil industry helped push the price of a barrel of oil up so dramatically that the amount of wealth that flew into the coffers of this industry is literally just unprecedented. In 2003, Exxon earned the highest profits of any corporation in world history. It then topped them in 2004. It topped them in 2005. It topped them in 2006, 2007. They were again up in 2008. 2009 saw a dip, but it looks like we're back up. The company that I follow the most closely, Chevron, like most of the industry in 2009, because of the fall of the price of oil, its profits about halved last year, but already in the first quarter of this year, it's doubled its profits from the first quarter of last year. So this industry just has an enormous amount of wealth, and I was very concerned about how that wealth was being translated into very aggressive political power, leading to environmental destruction, social destruction, but also war, one of the large consequences of that power. And my book was an analysis of that wealth and that power. It then led me to focus in on one company with this wonderful human rights organization that I work for, Global Exchange, to look at Chevron and to focus on campaigning around one company to see if that campaigning, pulling together communities affected by and fighting back against Chevron's operations all around the world, all across the country, could focus our energy on one company as a way to bring changes to the entire global oil industry.
This is Radio EcoShock. You have just heard from Antonio Juhas, author of The Tyranny of Oil, The World's Most Powerful Industry, and What We Must Do to Stop It. She's the director of the Chevron program at globalexchange.org. Thank you so much, Antonia.
All right. Well, thank you for having me.
A mile and a half under where humans can't go. We've punctured a hole into what we don't know. The oil is escaping all over the place. Is this the beginning, the end of our race?
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
What are we doing, drilling miles deep under the sea, all for precious oil? Richard Heinberg broke peak oil into the public mind with books like The Party's Over, Peak Everything, and Blackout. He's been a leader calling for a planned transition away from fossil fuels and a founder of the Post-Carbon Institute. Richard Heinberg, thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
It's my pleasure.
Well, the Deepwater Horizon spill in the Gulf of Mexico, it looks like a roving disaster area. If this goes on for months, how far might the damage spread?
Well, the oil is entering into the Gulf Current, which will take it around the southern tip of Florida and up the East Coast. So we could eventually see oil washing up on beaches all the way from Louisiana to Long Island. So this is, in terms of extent, there's no question this is going to be the biggest oil spill in history. There's still some, I would say, not exactly controversy, but uncertainty maybe is the better word as to actually how much oil is being released. The lower estimates now are saying 5,000 barrels of oil per day, and the higher estimates are saying more on the order of 200,000 to 250,000 barrels per day. So in terms of gallons, that's a range from 200,000 gallons to about 1 million gallons per day. Now, obviously, this is, it makes a huge difference as to whether it's the lower or higher figure. At the higher figure, this oil leak has already released almost as much oil as the Exxon Valdez disaster back in the 1980s in Alaska, and that would make it already the worst oil spill in history. It's certainly going to attain that status, even at the lower levels of leakage, over the next few weeks. So we're certainly looking at the worst oil spill in history.
Well, they drilled down more than a mile deep in the ocean and then another 3 miles or so into the crust of the earth to find this huge pool of oil. And I've heard this blowout described as an underwater volcano of oil. What are your thoughts on that?
Right. Well, I suppose that's a little bit of hyperbole, but nevertheless, we are talking about really an enormous amount of oil leaking into the ocean. And already, dead sea turtles are washing up on the Louisiana and Mississippi shore, and seabirds are being impacted. It's very clear that it's going to impact the fisheries quite catastrophically. In the worst case scenario, we won't see the Gulf fisheries recover for literally decades, a decade or two. In the best case scenario, it will only impact fisheries to the east of the Mississippi River, and there could be recovery within a few years. But looking at the volumes of oil that are being released and the enormous geographic extent that they're going to cover as a result of the ocean current, maybe an underwater volcano maybe isn't a bad metaphor after all.
Richard, you are a leader in peak oil. Is the industry going this deep and dangerous because oil reserves are dwindling?
What's happened is we've reached the end of cheap oil. You know, we used to find oil close to the surface in places like Southern California, Oklahoma, Texas. And we just don't find oil onshore in places that are cheap and easy to operate in like that anymore. You know, the oil companies wouldn't be drilling in a mile of ocean water and several miles of rock if they didn't absolutely have to. The whole process becomes that much more not only expensive, but also more dangerous as we proceed. Very often the press talks about, and deservedly so, the technological prowess of the oil industry these days. I mean, the ability to drill in these areas is quite mind-boggling. Sometimes a single exploratory well can cost $200 million, even $500 million to drill. It's remarkable what the industry can do these days, but as we add layers and layers of technological complexity, that just means that more can go wrong. And that's one of the problems with this particular rig explosion. The industry's never had to deal with an oil leak this far down in ocean water under these kinds of circumstances before. So they actually don't have a fix, you know, that they can apply right off the shelf. They're trying to do all kinds of things, building containment boxes that they can lower down over the leak, drill a relief well, as well as using containment booms and remote-controlled subs and dispersants. But nobody's sure if any of these things will work just because, you know, these are unique and unprecedented circumstances.
Isn't there a danger that this spill could drive more investment in dirtier energy from the Canadian tar sands to more coal or even nuclear?
Well, the irony is all of those alternatives have their own environmental problems that are potentially at least as bad as what we're looking at right now. The reality is the days of cheap, easy fossil fuel energy are over. The tar sands in Canada, an enormous environmental catastrophe unfolding there. And because it's far away from view, we really don't pay that much attention to it. Again, that's one of the eye-opening characteristics of what's going on in the Gulf right now. I mean, this is prime commercial fishery. So, and of course, people's memory of the hurricane in 2005, Katrina and Rita, is still fresh. So this understandably grabs people's attention. But what we're doing with regard to mountaintop removal, coal mining, and the mining of the tar sands is just as environmentally destructive. It's just that it's a little further away from view.
As long as it's hidden, we don't have to worry about it. Well, you know, for months we've had announcements of new oil discoveries all over the world with deep water exploration. It's sort of like the Holy Grail promised to the public. Yes, go on, keep driving those SUVs on the long commute to the suburbs. I'm wondering, could this be a real wake-up call?
Well, I think it will be at the level of policy and politics. The notion of drilling here and now and solving all of our energy problems that way, becoming energy independent by exploiting more of our own national oil reserves, I think that idea is going to come more and more into question as folks all along the east coast of the United States start seeing oil and tar washing up on their shores. Will it change the behavior of American drivers? Quite frankly, I'm not so sure. I think really the only thing that's going to change the behavior of most Americans in terms of what they're driving and how much they're driving is the cost of gas at the pumps. That will be going up. At least it will be becoming less and less affordable, inevitably, as we run through what's left of the world's cheap energy. And I think one of the impacts of this is that the U.S. will be forced once again to contemplate its dependence on oil in other countries. If exploiting our own offshore oil reserves is going to be this costly, not only in environmental terms, but also in terms of the horrendous costs of cleanup that are going to be borne not just by BP, but by federal governments, state governments, local governments, and so on. If those costs are going to be so high, then that just means the oil companies will have that much more incentive to look for oil in Africa, Central Asia, in the Arctic regions, and so on. So once again, we're thrown back on the geopolitics of oil and competing with other countries like China that also want access to the world's remaining oil.
And that means we have to keep the big military going.
Well, that will be the conclusion in some people's minds, I'm sure. Of course, the only responsible, rational conclusion from all of this is that we've got to reduce our reliance on this stuff. We've got to figure out a plan B where we can just rapidly taper off our national consumption of petroleum. It's going to happen anyway. I mean, this is a finite resource, and we're running through the cheap, easy stuff as fast as we can. So it's going to get harder and more expensive as time goes on. This is absolutely clear. No one disputes that. So we should be planning for that day and doing everything we can to reduce our reliance on oil, because that reliance is an enormous national vulnerability. I would go further. I would say that is the greatest vulnerability of our nation, is our utter and complete dependence on oil to fuel our economy.
Will we look back on this as just another accident, or do you think this really is a big event in our energy history?
Oh, there's no question. This is a big turning point. Just as the Exxon Valdez spill was a big turning point in many people's minds, this is going to be a much bigger one. This is going to be a kind of a defining moment in the history of our dependence on fossil fuels and oil in particular, because from here on, I don't think anyone can responsibly make the assumption or the statement that technology can solve these problems, and that we can drill for the stuff without any serious environmental risks. It's absolutely clear from now on that there are serious, very serious costs for continuing to extract and use this stuff.
What are the questions you want answered, the things you'll be looking for in the coming weeks?
Well, of course, answering the question as to the size of the leak, that will be very important, and seeing how successful some of these efforts are at containment. It'll also be interesting to see what the political response is, especially on the part of those who've been calling for more offshore drilling. You know, are they going to change their tune, or are they going to come up with some sort of elaborate new explanation for why things went wrong, perhaps even blaming environmentalists, who knows? It is going to be interesting to see how all of this unfolds. But the thing to remember, I think, really is that what we're seeing is just an enormous tragedy. It didn't have to happen, and we should do everything we can to make sure it doesn't happen again.
Richard Heinberg, I know you are busy. Thank you so much for helping us out.
Yes, thank you, Alex.
In his latest book, Searching for a Miracle, Net Energy Limits and the Fate of Industrial Society, Richard Heinberg examines 18 energy sources by their net energy and 9 other criteria. It was published jointly by the Post Carbon Institute and the International Forum on Globalization. Find out more at richardheinberg.com and postcarbon.org. This is Radio EcoShock. Here is just a spoonful from the net. Jason Leopold at truthout.org reports on a whistleblower, a former oil contractor claiming BP broke the law and its own procedures, as it did in the deadly 2005 Texas City oil refinery explosion. Another corporate accident waiting to happen, perhaps on BP's other giant deepwater platform, Atlantis. Excellent investigative journalism. Check it out by Jason Leopold. Last week's EcoShock guest, Nicholas Kozloff, has blistering blog entries on the spill at his blog at nicholaskozloff.com. The black history of BP and its cozy relationship with U.S. regulators. The Mississippi Sierra Club labels the Deepwater Horizon oil spill America's Chernobyl. Others, the oil volcano and even oil apocalypse. Find active discussion threads in the drumbeat postings at theoildrum.com and thedailycost.com. More continuing Gulf spill coverage at gulflive.com and maps at skytruth.org. The Alabama viewpoint from AL.com, where, for example, Ben Raines tells us a leaked Coast Guard memo fears the deepwater site could release even millions of gallons a day into the Gulf. There are tens of millions of barrels of oil and gas in this deposit, under high pressure, miles deep under the crust, now coming up. In the UK, the Times newspaper reveals BP knew of problems with the blowout preventer 10 years ago when it was installed. Operator Transocean admitted the preventer did not work properly on another rig, the Discoverer Enterprise. Other experts question the faults in the cement work around the wellhead performed by Dick Cheney's former company, Halliburton. Earlier in April, a team of scientists led by Daniel Esler from Simon Fraser University published a paper showing wildlife is still exposed to Exxon oil 20 years after that great tanker disaster. As Ricky Ott has documented in her books, oil on the beaches and tidewaters can never be cleaned up. The dispersants loaded into the deep ocean and airdropped on the surface may make the Gulf of Mexico history's largest chemical experiment. No one knows the harm coming. Everyone, even the harshest oil critics, hope or pray the BP jerry-rigged containment dome can seal off the very worst. Then we can go on as usual, wrecking the climate and the seas as we drive around. Except the very worst has already happened. Perhaps ocean drilling around the world is an endangered species. I'm Alex for Radio EcoShock. If only we could hear from an industry insider willing to speak out. In the 1990s, Anita Burke was Executive Vice President, Head of Climate Change and Sustainability Strategies Worldwide for Shell International. She left to found the Catalyst Institute. Anita has become a strong spokeswoman on peak oil and climate change. I last heard her speak at the first degrowth conference in North America on April 30th in Vancouver, Canada. Before I began, Anita was already moved by this developing disaster.
Before we begin, I just want to let you know that I just finally have had a chance to really look at some of the media, most recent media, about spill events. And wow, I didn't realize I was going to be so triggered from my experiences with the Exxon Valdez. And I have to say, just process a little bit, I have to say, when I just watched the video, the meeting with the fishermen, with the BP reps, and I had the most bizarre experience, Alex. It was like I was seeing the same meeting, exact meeting we had with at the Exxon Valdez, laid on top of this meeting. They're identical.
You know what? I think we're into the interview, Anita, and we are speaking with Anita Burke.
Hello.
When you say that, I have to agree, because I heard Obama on television last night saying exactly the same thing as George Bush said about Katrina. We're here as long as it takes, with as much as it takes, but in fact that never happened.
Yeah, you know, the thing is that the hard part with these sorts of incidents is that, again, they're incidents and they're sudden and they're a big surprise. But what's not really clear, I think, to the public from the outside and is that organizing that many people, getting contracts written, getting contracts signed, the logistical organization that it takes to marshal those resources effectively is almost like trying to build a large corporation within 2 days. And most, if not all, corporations or companies anywhere are not in any way prepared to unleash resources at that with that level of quickness and with effectiveness. The challenge is that you want to put all the, they probably desperately want to put all those fishermen to work with booms on their boats, but they also want to make sure that they get them paid, they get contracts, they get things set up. And those sorts of logistics can take 3 to 5 days to generate, and it's so difficult because in the meantime, that spill's just getting worse.
Yes, indeed. There have been fishermen complaining if they could have got out there on day two or three, but then BP wasn't giving the right information about the size of the spill at the time.
That's correct, and I will hold BP accountable for underestimating both the volume of the oil and the severity and difficulty of arresting an uncontrollable damaged wellhead at the subsurface of the ocean in these conditions.
As a person with deep insider experience in the oil industry, is it possible that these costs, I've heard $14 billion and counting, and that's without the lawsuits, and the public reaction, could it endanger BP as a company?
No, I don't think that it'll endanger BP as a company. It's certainly going to compromise their share price, their profitability, and they'll be redirecting resources. And they've got reserves. Remember, most of the major multinational oil corporations are self-insured, which means that they do have to hold reserves against risk. And so they do have that available. That's not to say that it isn't going to significantly harm the brand, and they've worked very hard to be the leading image of the oil industry with regards to green power and beyond petroleum. So this will erode and put them in a negative space with regards to that position.
What might they do if you were in the BP executive offices? What might they do to spin this as damage control?
They can't. At this point, if they're spending any time at all in the executive offices worrying about spending this for damage control, they're wasting time. Frankly, there is really no political statement they can make to manage the damage. Their best, and I think I know the people at British Petroleum historically, and I believe this is part of their culture. I believe they will truly and sincerely stand up and own that it's their responsibility, and they will do everything they can to make things right. Now, don't get me wrong. They've got a whole floor of lawyers that are going to be working very diligently to do everything they can to mitigate British Petroleum's risk and fiscal exposure. And I do believe that they will work hard to do the right thing.
What if the public did demand an end to deep water drilling? I don't see that happening, but there may be at least some stiff and prohibitive regulations. How could that impact our future oil supplies? Would it hasten the end of the oil age, for example?
You know, that's a really good question. And based on the information I have about remaining reserves, identified reserves, and extractable reserves, really, it's a bigger question, frankly. My big question is, what are we doing spending all this money chasing deep water oil reserves when they'll only add another year or maybe even 6 months of additional crude for our appetite that we have right now? And so these are marginal contributions as it is. And frankly, I do believe, and I'm grateful for this, that this spill has come ironically, at a very, very important moment on the public stage, and it will compromise future abilities to drill offshore, both off the British Columbia coast and also off the coast of Florida and other coastal regions that they're looking at.
It might even help to protect the Arctic. They want to go drilling up there.
These kinds of events, the silver lining here, how tragic it is, result in a public outcry and a maladaptive appetite for allowing this sort of thing to go forward. If there's any blessing at all here, it may be that this event protects sacred waters and sacred ecosystems in the future from similar incidents.
Anita, do you want to talk to the technical challenges facing BP trying to stop this gusher of oil?
Sure. I've been invited to come down, and I'm a little nervous because this is an almost an unsolvable challenge. Imagine if you will, you're down in the bottom of the sea. It's very silty anyway. There's a lot of it's murky, it's muddy, it's unclear, and the velocity of that oil coming out of that wellhead at the surface of the land and the subsurface of the ocean, at the ocean floor, is like this being hit by, literally by a freight train. And so you're going to take a diver down there. these guys, somebody has to now get close enough to the wellhead to put dynamite in the hole to blow it up. And that is the only, and it's nearly impossible to do that. So their only other option at this juncture is to drill a relief well, and I know that they're rapidly trying to do that, although that can take anywhere from 10 days to 14 days to complete and then seal off the current pipe that's allowing it to be leaking out of the reservoir. So we're looking at anywhere from, honestly, 10 to 14 more days of a crude coming out of that wellhead at a minimum.
I'll be amazed if they do it in that time from what I've seen. And both BP and the government have publicly worried that sand coming up with the oil could cut through the pipes and the wellhead. I'm not sure what they're talking about. What could that do?
What that does is it erodes. Imagine, if you will, that you've got the place on your car where you're putting the gas in, and all of a sudden there's a little corrosion thing just below the wall of the car, right on the pipe between the gas tank and that fill part, and that thing corrodes and breaks off. Well, how do you get in there and fix it without taking everything apart and digging out a giant hole around that pipe to try and get down to where it's broken off? If it breaks off in the subsurface, there's no way to seal it from the top at that juncture. And then directionally drilling into the right point to intersect that pipeline with the alternative drilling system to cap it and seal it becomes extremely complex because you're not sure at what depth the pipe is ruptured.
Oh, my, my. Well, if the big dome they're proposing doesn't work or they can't get this relief well in place, is it possible the whole reservoir could just keep emptying out into the Gulf?
That's a very big possibility. I'd give that possibility probably anywhere from a 60% chance that will be the outcome. We're at that point. It's that much of a crapshoot.
Richard Heinberg, I've just talked with him, and he suggests this gusher may be a turning point for the oil industry, and yet everyone listening to the news from the Gulf still plans to drive their car around, and we're still wearing and buying oil-based products. Can you briefly give us any ideas how we can get off this fossil merry-go-round before we lose our whole civilization out of it?
Stop driving your car. Stop buying stuff, aggressive consumption, and really seek to displace any material codependent on hydrocarbons, oil, gas, with other alternative materials that are renewable and sustainable. It's a huge call for our civilization generally, and this is just yet another poignant reminder. And may I say that it's not just the oil coming out of the ground, but people keep forgetting that 11 men gave their lives so that we could drive our cars to the 7-Eleven and pick up a Coke. And I think we really need to think about that with regards to our own sort of asleep kind of and sort of sense that we're it's our right to have that level of freedom and mobility almost at any cost. And if anything, I would hope that every citizen in North America or anywhere in the world that's using oil will take a moment to feel the full personal responsibility for those men's deaths and the current travesty that's occurring in the Gulf right now.
And for the fishermen whose grounds are closed, and then we have all the innocent creatures, some of them that we barely know about, will all be damaged by this.
This is very true.
Yeah. Have I missed something? Is there another message you'd like to leave with our listeners?
What I'd like to leave with the listeners is do everything you can to send positive and supportive prayers and thoughts to the people that are working down there, even those working for BP. Those folks aren't sleeping. They're faced with horrific decisions. We need them to be the best they can be. And while it may sound ironic that they need our support, they do. They're the ones on the front line that are going to have the chance to solve this issue. Let's not beat them up. Let's not try and be armchair, folks. We have no idea what they're up against. And let's instead hold a state of faith and confidence that we can support them through prayer and our own positive thoughts to do the best they can do. I'm reminded of a line from the movie Armageddon, and it's like, do a good job, do a good job, do a good job, please do a good job. And so I ask everyone out there to pray for everyone who's been involved. Look at your own personal life and how you're contributing to them needing to pump oil out of the ground and make those changes immediately, if for no other reason than to honor those 11 men that gave their lives for us to have this luxury.
Anita Burke, I thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you, Alex. It's always a pleasure.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
A self-described aging hippie songwriter and futurist from Oakland, California, Dana Pearson, like many of us, was struck down by the magnitude of the Gulf Gusher and our foolishness. While working for the Government Accounting Office, Pearson found green solutions a generation ago. Now he's welded oil anguish into a song for the spill with its world premiere on Radio EcoShock. Here is Dana Pearson with Corporate Catastrophe.
Oil is a-coming from deep down below. Fishies and shrimpies have nowhere to go. Can't seem to stop it, it's out of control. Corporate catastrophe is running the show. Feet under, where humans can't go. We've punctured a hole in the planet, oh no. And oil is escaping all over the place. This is the beginning, the end of our race. See the 6 billion barrels of oil down there. What will we do?
What will we do?
Oh, yeah. How do we stop it? Well,
that's a good question.
Should ask that. How do we stop it? It's a corporate catastrophe.
Corporate catastrophe.
Corporate catastrophe.
Corporate catastrophe.
Corporate catastrophe.
Corporate catastrophe.
Corporate catastrophe. All their lies about safety for years and years. Everything that's happened was beyond our worst fears. And it ain't true. Came true. So what you gonna do?
What you gonna do?
What you gonna do?
What you gonna do?
What you gonna do? It's a corporate catastrophe.
Corporate catastrophe.
A corporate catastrophe.
Corporate catastrophe.
It's a corporate catastrophe.
Corporate catastrophe.
It's a corporate catastrophe.
Corporate catastrophe.
We've been killing the ocean. It's gone on for a while. Can we stop it? It's looking quite bad. While the sun waits above, oh, it makes me so mad. There's 4 to 6 billion barrels down there. 4
to 6 billion barrels of oil down there. Pressurized like a hot air balloon. Go solar, man. Use the sun before it's too late.